This is Gordon Bowrer, interviewed at his home at Upton-by-Chester in Cheshire by Chris Alden Lee on the 21st of September 2010. Gordon Bowrer, Part 1.
Gordon Trevor Bowrer. And place of birth, London. 28th of the 6th, 1936.
So you're 70...
74 now.
And looking very well on it.
Oh, got a couple of stents in. I blame the fat. I got addicted to fat when I was in the Antarctic, I'm sure.
How do you mean?
Butter, fat, cheese.
Can you explain why that happened?
Well, on dog journeys, the amount of food you needed to maintain your weight tended to be about 5,000 calories or plus or minus. Mm-hmm. And the only way you get that amount of calories in is to have a lot of fat, which is why the diet is has, you know, tins of fat and in the form of butter. And so you, if you want more calories, you have more butter. And I have always loved cheese and cheese and biscuits. So there you go.
And you think? Do you genuinely think that because of your interest in butter
in the 60s,
this has shaped the rest of your life medically?
Probably has. But if you think in terms of during the war, things like bread and dripping were the norm, if you could. So I've always liked peanut butter, fat, ordinary butter.
Was this passion for butter and cheese unique to you, or did to some of your other foods?
I don't know.
Feel the same way?
I don't know. I've really never talked to anybody about it, really.
That's what these interviews are for. Did he become compulsive? Did he start stealing butter or bargaining with your
family? No. I mean, if the food, you saw the food boxes. I don't know how much they changed over the years of when we had them, because I was talking about, 1960s, early 60s. But what they did contain, I think, I can't really remember, but I think it was probably about near 5,000 calories a day, 4,000 something, 4,800 or something. I really can't remember. And get that information, no doubt.
Did I read somewhere that, in fact, butter became a kind of a prized item that people used to swap it or deal with it?
The only reason it was swapped, people travelling in muskegs would not need as many calories, but they were taking the same food boxes. If you were with the dogs, you wanted more. Alan Etchells always said, "Well, we stripped their food boxes of butter."
So you go and pillage the muskeg food boxes?
Yes, literally. Absolutely. Yes, yes.
Was this
on the journey? You know, yeah, on journey
in the field.
Yeah, in the field.
Was it? This was a cause of amusement or tension?
Apparently, to Alan, it was a cause of amusement. But I don't think they. They didn't finish their boxes. They didn't eat everything that there was.
So in the mid-60s, Bass perhaps hadn't got to the point of considering designing food boxes for the work to be done with them.
Oh, I'm sure they did, right. Because there weren't very many... I mean, Halibay was, at that time, really the only base that had any tractor travel, I think. I know there were muskegs elsewhere, but I think they were mainly base tractors, not expedition vehicles. I mean, we use them as expedition vehicles, but basically they're just tractors.
So what was in fact happening was that they had a standard food box issued to sledging teams.
That's right.
And the same box went to the muskegs, despite the fact that men didn't eat so much fat.
Absolutely right.
It could have been worse. You could have been addicted to seal blubber, couldn't you?
Well, you could have been. I don't think any of us... It's only the dogs that got that way.
Okay.
and the dogs would go for the blubber. They would, yes.
Because they needed it?
I presume so.
Let's go back then to a bit earlier in your life. Tell me a bit about your background, your childhood and your education.
I was brought up in... We were evacuated. We lived in Edgware. My father was evacuated to Ashted in Surrey during the war. And so we lived in Surrey, Ashted. The office he worked for the Coal Board, what was then the National Coal Board. The office he worked at in London remained intact throughout the war. The one that he worked in Surrey had 8 sticks of bombs across it eventually at the end of the war. And my school, my primary school, was blown flat by a doodlebug. Absolutely. Nobody killed because it was just after everybody went home. But, so we did have things happening around us. And my collection of shrapnel was extensive.
How did you, as a child, you would have been how old then, roughly?
Well, as a child, well, we were 1939, I would have been 4. And my primary school was a primary school, basically.
Yeah. How do you think you reacted to it being blown up at the age of 4? And...
I don't know. We missed about a week of the end of the summer term, and they had it all up and running again with prefabs at the start of the autumn term. I remember being rather put out about that. Thought we'd get a bit longer.
I suppose my question is because talking to FIDs who have narrow squeaks, it sometimes changes the way they view things in the future. Perhaps at the age of 4, you were too young to adjust your thinking.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I would be later than that. It would be 44, wouldn't it? And I would have been 8.
Mm.
I would have been about 8, wouldn't I?
But you don't think it changed your view of...
No, they were just doodle bugs.
Yeah.
And, I mean, our house had the... had some blast injuries from the V2s, one of the rockets, which fell about half a mile away, but still got blast injuries on the house.
I mean, the Blitz definitely had an impact on the psychology of a generation, didn't it?
People
probably, yes. Feeling as though they were lucky to be alive.
I don't think we think about it. I mean, we were children.
Okay, fair enough.
It wasn't.
Is Bower an English name entirely?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Very much so.
How far back does it go?
1645, and it goes where there was a chirurgeon surgeon called... what was his name? Thomas Bower, I think it was. Thomas Bower. And it was really Sussex-Surrey-Kent borders. It's a long-established name. The early Bowerers, I think, were... there's a book about them. smugglers. Smugglers from the Kent coast, I think.
Okay.
Taking baccy and brandy up to London, no doubt.
When do you think you began to start thinking about entering a medical profession? Were you that way inclined as a child? Did it come much later?
It obviously came from school. I had a very, what I regard as interesting school days when I was... I was a day boy at school in a boarding school, and that was Epsom College. Epsom College in Epsom tended to be a medical school. People used, most of the pupils there went on to become doctors. So you became ingrained.
So was Epsom chosen because you were thinking already?
No, it's because it was up the road, three miles up the road.
Right. So there's a certain amount of indoctrination, is there?
Well, no, but I mean, apart from the original surgeon who started the name as Bowra, there weren't many. I don't think we had any. It was not part of a family. I had no family connection with doctors.
Right.
None at all. My interest probably was in animals, so veterinary could have been part of my training. But I worked in a racing stables in Epsom during the holidays. And after seeing racehorses, I never wanted to do... I never wanted to go into veterinary again.
And when do you think your interest in the Antarctic was first sparked? What was your first brush?
Oh, when I was probably... I read some of the books around probably when I was about 12. You know, I read some of the original adventure books then. But from a point of view of when I was already qualified, that was... And I'd been on duty. I'd been up for a very long time when I was working in Eastbourne, St Mary's Hospital, Eastbourne. And I came into the coffee room, the common room, and there happened to be a film on at the time. I had my cup of coffee. There happened to be a film on, and it was by Neil Orr. About dog sledging, and I didn't know what to do. I'd done my 6 months in surgery, and the also as a physician, I knew was the next step had been arranged. What I didn't know was what I was going to do after that. No way I wanted to do. Midwifery or anything like that, and I didn't know what to do after that. And it had just National Service had just finished. We were in, I think, about a year after National Service had finished, so that wasn't part of my outlook, obviously, which it would have been a couple of years before. And I just saw this this film of Neil Orr with dog sledging. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And so I got in touch with the survey, or rather tried to get in touch with Vivian Fuchs at that time. And that's when it all started.
It seems slightly odd that that film should be being shown.
Yeah, absolutely.
You never got to the bottom of
No, it was just on. It was on TV. On TV. It was on TV. The TV was on, as it often was, in the corner of the coffee, you know, where the cup of coffee was. And you just slumped down.
And this would be 1960.
And that would have been probably 61. Yes, 61.
Does Neil
60 or 61?
60, does 60. Neil know that he inspired you to go?
I don't know. I mean, I've talked to him a lot before that. When we were at the when we worked at the physiology laboratory at
It doesn't matter. Don't worry about the time.
No, you forget. Yeah. So I mean, I knew Neil quite. I knew Neil well.
Subsequent
even
to
went
the
sailing with him at one time. Right. Yeah.
Okay. So let's just look at this. And you wrote. You actually wrote to Fuchs himself.
Yes.
And I presume you got a reply.
I can't remember about that, but obviously I must have done because. Because when he talked about, it, he said, "Go away and do something." So I went away and. Walked up and down Leadenhall Street, so I got myself a berth on a boat going to South Africa.
So, sorry, let's just backtrack slightly. Did he ever get an interview with
you? Oh, yes.
Folks, yeah. What, do you remember anything of it?
No.
Okay. But the consequence was you had to...
The consequence was, yeah, I've been apart from the fact go away and do something, so... So there must have been, I must have had a formal interview, but I really can't remember that. But there will have been, you know, people like, there will have been a representative of the Foreign Office, I think, and probably Bill Sloman, I expect.
When he said go away and do something, what do you think he meant?
Oh, anything, you know.
What, because you weren't old?
It's the wrong time of year, and... Right. It was probably early on, February or something. The boats don't go till
November.
That's right.
So did he offer you a place?
At that time, do you know, I honestly can't remember.
Okay. That's fair enough.
But I think they were interested in having doctors.
What did you go away and do?
Well, I went as ship surgeon on the SS City of Pretoria.
You just walked onto the ship and offered your services?
No, I went down Leadenhall Street, got to Elliman and Bucknell Lines it was, and actually tried all the various shipping agents, which in those days you could, down Leadenhall Street. But it wasn't unusual, because I had friends who were qualified who'd also got on the boats... As well, one was going out to New Zealand, I think, and you know, it was a journey. One set of articles, deep sea articles.
So, tell me about your time on the Pretoria.
The city of Pretoria. It wasn't a very long time. It was a glorious. I'd been clearly at that up to that time. I'd been working in hospitals, and. I'd never known that there was anything outside solid work 7 days a week. And this was a glorious holiday for me, if you like, on the City of Pretoria, who was a cargo, carried 12 passengers, and just went out to Beira eventually. Portuguese East Africa, Lourenço Marques and Beira. And we took, and I clearly saw at that point, we went out half empty and came back laden to the gunwales, so to speak. So this was the at that time the gap between export and import. Mm. See it very clearly.
Were you required to do any doctoring on this?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, I was employed as a ship surgeon.
Do you remember what you might have had, what you did? No.
I wouldn't, I probably wouldn't tell you if I... if I did remember. I do remember a couple of things, yes, but I wouldn't...
What sorts of things? Without breaking patient confidentiality?
Oh, no.
You
no,
can't
no,
talk
no,
about
no.
it? Okay, fair enough.
But it wasn't very onerous as far as I was concerned on the medical side.
Well, that was a point I was going to make. Presumably you were dealing largely with young, fit people.
No, no. No, we're talking about people who paid a lot of money to go out to South Africa at that time. And they were mostly elderly, obviously. No, they were all elderly, I think. And I did have some, I mean, I knew some people of some people in South Africa, and I managed to actually go to see them and to see a couple of game parks and things like that while I was there, but while we were in port in Durban. So I managed to combine an awful lot of pleasure with a little business.
But the allure of the Antarctic was strong enough not to make you want to carry on sailing the warm seas?
No, I was offered a job in South Africa, but at that time, I did not wish to go to South Africa. I wouldn't, would
For
not
political
have lived
reasons.
There. I wouldn't have liked to live there.
Right. Because of the racial problems?
No, a whole series of other things. I mean, there were problems. The people that I went to see was the manager of a sugar plantation, the Tongat sugar plantation, which was a huge, a really huge place. But there were, you know, the problems of Africa at that time seemed to me between English and Boer and Indian and African. Mm-hmm. They were separate. They were separate problems.
Okay. Let's just recap a little bit about what it was. You read the books about Scott and
Amundsen. Shackleton.
Okay.
Yes.
What in the end was it tips the balance to make you want to apply to FIDS?
I don't know. It was different. It seemed that I liked the idea of dog sledging. I liked the idea of that. And as I say, I don't know what the film was, but it was presumably a half-hour film, and it was presumably from Hope Bay. And it was that actually made me want to go south. Okay. Yeah, really. Seemed a good idea at the time. It's the usual thing.
You'd be amazed number of FIDs that say that.
Well, life was like that at that time. I mean, I had some very interesting times when I was at school because we were in the combined cadet force at school. And that meant that I did a lot of flying while I was at school. So things like the only way of travelling at that time was to get somebody to pay the ticket. Mm. You couldn't go. I think, as far as I remember, I think it was about £12 you were allowed to take out of the country, something like that. And It wasn't common to go abroad, apart from if you were in the forces. And a lot of my friends had very interesting times while they were in the forces. They learned all sorts of things. Some of them went and learned Russian at Cambridge or whatever. And one man spent his whole time skiing. And then broke his leg just before the Olympics.
Okay.
But it was, you know, quite common to... most of my friends had a lot of interesting things, but that was when they were in doing national service as either a two-year or a three-year commission.
So you saw it as a ticket to travel?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, jolly good. Tell me about then the journey south. What do you remember? What ship were you on? Did it leave on time? Was there the usual delay?
Well, I remember, yes. The one thing I do remember, it was the Kista Dan, and this was the hired ship. And I remember walking onto the quay at Southampton and seeing the Queen Mary, or Queen Elizabeth, I can't remember which one, in the distance. And then not seeing anything on the quay where just a couple of sticks coming up.
A couple of masts.
And then we looked down and there was the Kista.
What was she like to sail in?
Obviously very much smaller. I mean, being at that time, obviously used to being on the City of Pretoria, obviously a lot smaller. And a diesel ship rather than a steam turbine. The one I went on was a steam turbine. She was smaller.
Comfortable?
I think we were quite comfortable, yes. But it was a very much smaller... the whole thing was very much smaller than I had been used to as a... on the City of Pretoria.
You were engaged to be a doctor?
Yes.
I guess, so that would be a variety of skills from surgery to GP to
yes.
to nurse and so on, and yes. maybe even a bit of animal husbandry too. Did you get to choose the equipment you took with you, and if so, what did you take?
Any research that was done, you took the equipment with you, but the actual medical supplies were part of base issue, of which there was a list. Some were quite extraordinary things, I thought, for the South, but on the whole, there's, you know, it was set for you, really.
What was extraordinary?
Well, I think there was some athlete's foot powder and things like that, which seemed to me for the Antarctic seemed to be a little bit extraordinary, I thought.
And what in time to come did you discover was missing? Were there things that were not supplied?
No, I really can't. Think about that.
Okay.
To be honest.
Were the things which you later recommended?
I can't remember.
No,
I can't remember.
Okay, that's fine. All right.
Yes, the actual medicines weren't really, I mean, apart from antibiotics and things, weren't really part of our they weren't used as much as... I really can't remember very
Don't
much
worry,
about them.
Did you mention a research programme? Did you actually have one to take with you?
I did, but not very successfully because I couldn't really get it to work. What I wanted to do was to measure the microclimate of hands. It was basically a Wheatstone bridge idea, and I could not get the continuous recorder to work properly. So that was rather sad as far as I was concerned.
It wouldn't work because it was broken or because the conditions?
No,
cold as
it was in the early days of continuous recording things, and it was recording small changes in resistance across knitted gloves, which my girlfriend knitted, or the current girlfriend knitted at the time.
So what was the thinking behind that? Why did you choose to want to research?
Well, we wanted to know whether you adapted to cold or whether you got used to... whether you just got used to being cold, or whether you, what the circulation was like. I wouldn't like to think back to that now, at the moment, because I can't remember.
Okay.
To be honest,
is this the kind of work that Ian Hampton later picked
up? Well, Ian was doing some different. I can't even remember. I can't remember what Ian was doing, and I can't remember what Neil was doing had done, because Neil by that time would have come back from Hope Bay, and they were writing up their things at Hampstead, at the laboratories in Hampstead, and I can't honestly remember what they were doing at all.
Okay. Had you also hoped, or did you later on decide to do some work on the dogs as well?
That was entirely, that was something that grew when my
original project
fell by the wayside. Mm.
Can you elaborate on that a bit? Can you elaborate on what?
Oh, well, what I did was measure the rectal temperatures of the huskies, and they were out on the spans in all weathers, down to -50 or what have you. So. I thought, did they adapt to the temperature? Did they drop their body temperatures? They actually did.
In a controlled way.
Statistically, yes, yeah. It was. But it was interesting just to measure the core temperatures of the dogs.
And the long-term value of that was what, would you say?
I think they tried to take, to put the dogs in. They took them inside at a later stage, I think, but I can't. I don't know. I don't know exactly.
But you were trying to establish that the dogs were perfectly healthy.
Oh yes.
In very cold conditions, it wasn't.
Yes, that's right.
It wasn't distressful for them.
No. Well, not apparently.
Was having a thermometer shoved up your bum distressful for the dogs?
No, not as far as it will. I mean, no, they always liked a bit of attention.
At either end.
At either end, yes, you did require two people.
You did?
Yeah. One to hold a dog and one. Yes.
How did your colleagues react to this rather unusual?
I thought it was unusual, I thought. I think.
Okay. When you were embarking, did you know where you were going to end up? Did you know you were going to go to Halley?
Well, I did when we were embarking, but earlier on I thought I would go to a base that had that was dog sledging, i.e. down the peninsula, Marguerite Bay or somewhere of that nature. But at the time, there wasn't any travel from, or there wasn't a lot of travel from Halley Bay. It had only just, the routes had only just been discovered over the Dawson-Lambton Glacier, over the, what then became known as a Bob Pye crossing.
Do you know where that name came from?
Yes. In Jarman, it was Bob and Pye. Pye Jarman, I think it was, and Bob somebody. I've actually forgotten the name.
Okay.
But it was basically a Bob Pye that's what they were called. And the original Bob Pye crossing that they went up onto inland ice was nowhere near where we found a way over. But they went over by dogs. We were taking tractors over.
Mm, okay. We may come to that a bit later on, but before I just leave that particular topic, in one of the base reports for the years you were there, the base commander, base leader, as it were then, said that the Bob Pye crossing demanded respect.
Yes.
Well, do you know why he would have said that?
I will show you a picture of why I said that.
Give me a word picture now.
Well, the cake went down a crevasse.
Right.
First time they went out, yeah. There was a lot of crevasses. A very jumbled area.
So dangerous territory?
Oh, yes. Very.
Were you there when the muskeg went down?
No, I wasn't. We were going with the dogs. But I have pictures.
So you saw it?
In pictures, yes.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay. Photographs later on. We'll come to that perhaps in the second part of the interview. What other medical duties were you required to do in the end? I mentioned earlier about FIDS being fairly young and fairly fit, so doctors, the demands upon doctors were not that great for their medical skills, I suspect. Or am I wrong?
Probably not from medical school skills. Although people really did have some, really had some very difficult things to deal with over the years. Not myself, but I spent, I suppose, I spent more in dentistry at the time, doing dentistry at the time I was there. And the dentist who went down to the peninsula, I spent his time doing medicine. We obviously got it the wrong way around.
Had you been trained in dentistry?
Yes, well, we went to the dental hospital to be shown the basics, shall we say.
This was a specific training because you were going...
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, absolutely. South. Oh, yes, absolutely.
Did you take to it?
Did I?
Take to dentistry?
No, but I did have some interesting periods when I was on the... Yes, I had to take a I had to take a molar out of a stoker on the city of Pretoria. Now, this was a steam turbine ship, so the stokers was not a small fella. And he had his hands gave me help in pulling out the offending molar.
Oh, right.
It's funny. Yeah.
I've got a note here from Alan Etchells about you having to attend to a bad tooth for one of your colleague Fids. I'll tell you what he says, and you can perhaps elaborate on it. After a couple of hours of trying to get this tooth sorted, he gave up and asked the patient to come back the next day after he'd had time to check the book.
Can't remember a thing about
it. You can't? Okay.
No. Yeah. No All right. idea.
But presumably you did have a library of sorts down there to refer to.
Oh, yes. Yes, I can't even remember how much we... No, I really can't remember.
And the dentist on the other side of the peninsula, we were able to consult with him on radio?
Not at that time, no. Radio was very, very primitive at that time. We did have radio skeds with other bases. And there clearly must have been communication with what was in those days London. But it was much more difficult than it is
today.
Mm-hmm. And you,
so you really were on left to your own
devices? You're absolutely on your own, yes.
Was that okay? Were you comfortable with that, or did you feel at all vulnerable?
It was just part of the thing. You went away for it was just part of the life at that time.
Mm.
There wasn't much help around, I think.
It was a norm.
Mm.
Okay. When you arrived at Halley, what were your impressions of it? Because it wasn't in the best of conditions.
No, I mean, it was just there. It was a completely different sort of base to that which would have been on land. You couldn't put anything down because it would disappear. So therefore, all the dumps of stuff you unloaded from the ship would have to be well marked, because if you dropped something in the snow, it would just disappear.
Because
so everything had to be marked.
Accumulation of snow,
yes. Or not necessarily accumulation, but blowing snow, yeah, because of wind.
So if you lost something in a blizzard, that was the end of that, was it?
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
What about the buildings, Gordon?
Well, the buildings were... Well, underground. You approached them through a shaft, down a ladder, in other words. And although you could see where a building was because of chimneys, you couldn't necessarily see anything of the building itself. No, I can't remember my original impression of the base. It was just there. That was what it was. And there was a whole series of aerials or wires or shafts, things just sticking up out of the snow. So, yeah.
When you got down into the buildings, were they falling apart?
The original building was the IGY hut, which put up during International Geophysical Year, which was about 1958, I think that was. Was it 58? Something like that. And we were 60, 62, or was it 63?
63.
So it had been, it had been there for a few years, and that was about 45 foot underground. And that was twisted, and if you can think of a chimney 45 foot high, with a shear on it, it was like that rather than straight.
That's a right angle.
Yeah, it was, yeah. And the pressure of ice had had a very large effect on the building itself. Now, the main living hut was at about 15 foot, I think, down. And that was a hut that went down, and there was problems in building that hut. It was meant to be the ground story of a two-story hut, but the bolts didn't go to the same base as the hut did. And as a result, it would have been very much a cobbled together by the people that, by the builders that built it at the time. Interesting thing where the bits don't go to the same base.
And did it leak?
Oh yes. Oh yes. You, as you were warm, you got a cave above the building itself, but water used to drip to come in, and that water would be variable, but we usually caught it in string. It used to run along strings into a bucket or something like that, which used to be emptied every now and again. Old food tins, as far as I remember.
Yeah. How was it to live like that? Because you were spending a lot of time, particularly in the winter, underground, in unreliable circumstances, shall we say. Did that have any... You're a doctor, you... Did it affect people psychologically?
Well, I don't know. There were, I think there were 24 of us there, and there were probably about seven or eight people who spent most of their time out, who spent their time outside. There were others that spent their time inside. And there were obviously the in-betweeners. I was definitely one of the outside people, quite apart from the dogs. They had to be fed and things like that. But there was always jobs around the bases. And, yeah, there were outside people, and I was one of them.
Did you notice any claustrophobia or depression because of the... living underground or living...
No, I don't think it had anything to do with it. I don't know that people were particularly depressed. There was periods where, yeah, where the odd individual... Yes, yeah, so there was real problems with one or two individuals. But I don't necessarily think that... the place was different. We were different to, I think, the other bases. If we had had views of, if we had could look out of the window and could see a mountain or something like that, it would be very different. But we weren't. So it, life just took on a...
was there anything
you became that, used to it.
Anything that could be done to help anybody who began to feel unhappy about their circumstances?
No, people used to. It was very much a community, not a series of individuals. It was a very good self-support. What we were known as a self-supportive community of people.
So there was.
No, they were all different types. Everybody was a different type of person. Mm. Some people had. Some people had seen, well, I mean, there were people that had been down there before. There was, I mean, like the base leader, and in fact the next base leader as well, been down to the Antarctic before. I think there were just a large... although everybody was individualistic, it was a very close community the first year, I think.
So are you saying that prevented people from becoming depressed, or that helped them if they did become depressed?
I think there was a... you had a ridiculous sense of humour. And even in the most adversity, it came through, I think.
Can you remember examples of
no
ridiculousness?
Well, one bloke used to... you would be working at the bottom of a shaft somewhere and the bloke would come falling down and get up and walk away. It was not unusual. It's always the same bloke. Different shafts, but he'd always fall down.
He just fell in.
Yeah, well, you know, people got themselves into... I mean, there were some scrapes, but I think it was very amusing. I think a lot of us had a lot of a sense of humour was very high, I think.
It's a long winter, isn't it? You did two of them.
Yes, but the time went, just disappeared so quickly. Because you were so busy doing things, for trying to alter things for the summer journeys. So time did not drag. It was not, that was not part of the
problem
at all. There wasn't, well, at least not for me, and I might have done for some people, but not for me.
I gather there was quite a serious card school.
Oh, yes. The first year was absolutely... when I say serious card school, there were probably every night at least three tables. So that's 12 people involved in bridge.
Did you play?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely, yes.
Was this played for money?
Oh, no.
You didn't have any money.
No. Oh, presumably there was. Yes. We were getting paid. I can't remember what it was. The pay was different for different people. Yeah, you got. I think it was £450 a year, £450 a year, and I think you got £50 if you had a degree. If you had a double degree, you got £200. So it was some.
Well, what I meant was you had no coins in which to gamble.
No, nothing at all.
Tell me about the attempts to make a card table.
Yes, I made a card table. I made a card table.
Where did you make it?
In the lower hut, in the IGY hut. There was one problem with this, and that was getting it out up through the hatches. The legs rather exceeded the width of the... there was a problem, as no doubt Alan's told you. There was a problem in getting... in getting the table up into the upper hut. Yeah.
How was the problem solved?
I can't remember. They could probably took the legs off again.
Oh, so you managed, really you managed to solve
it? Oh, yeah. Yes.
Was this a rather...
There was no problem we couldn't solve, apart from light bulbs. I don't think we could ever solve the problem of lack of light bulbs. But
can you elaborate on that?
Most things... You could make somebody had some idea of how to make whatever it was you thought you required. Fids were very inventive people.
But the wooden light bulb had defeated you.
Absolutely.
So you got it in. No. At some point, you got this Gordon Bower table into the
yes.
main hut.
Oh, yes, absolutely. That was a card table. Still there, no doubt it was, still in the, as it floated out to sea, I expect.
Did you Did he miss the fact that it was an all male society? Did he miss the other gender?
I don't really think that you did. Some people may have done, but I think you were too interested in it was really quite a physical. It was very much a physical environment then. Humping boxes around, cutting up seal meat, humping seals around, catching them. No, it was very much a physical environment, and I think we were possibly too busy. I don't know. Some people wouldn't have been because everybody had different jobs to do. And a lot of people became involved in jobs that were nothing to do with them, but required doing.
Mm.
You know, digging out supplies, or digging out the drums of fuel, bringing them from the dumps to in some ways becoming involved in the maintenance of tractors and things like that.
So when you signed up to be a doctor, did they explain that you'd be doing lots of other things too?
No, I don't think so.
But you kind of guessed, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, I don't think. I don't think we considered that.
Did you take to the physical work?
Yes, very much so.
So you didn't object?
No.
No.
No, absolutely not.
I guess it was all hands to the pump, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So would women have fitted into 60s fiddery?
Probably not. I wouldn't have thought. I think it was a bit rough, to be honest. We were still in the days of, what shall I say, the post-war days, I think, of sealing wax and string. So I think everything was, you know, you were make, do and mending at that time with what you had. You knew what you had, right.
But even the scientists in your era were doing physical work as well, they weren't?
Oh, yes, I think so.
They weren't just scientists.
Well, I mean, I went out with a geologist. Well, you've got to carry his rocks. Someone's got to do it. they tend to... And, yes, but I was very lucky in actually spending a lot of time off base. And I say lucky, because we did think it was...
privilege.
We were absolute privilege
to
be in areas that nobody had ever been to before, to climb every little bit of rock that was there that nobody had ever climbed before. And there were some lovely days, apart from the days spent lying up with a howling gale.
I will ask you about that in the second half of the interview, if I may, so in a few minutes' time. I've got a couple more thoughts to ask you before we stop for a cup of tea. There's a chap called Doug Finlayson. Remember Doug? Do that name
ring? Dougie, yes.
Yeah. My enduring memory of Gordon was him screaming when we were in the process of euthanizing the cat Strom from South Georgia. Is this something that stays in your mind?
Well, I can remember it. I can remember it. He never did anything to help. I can remember, yes, poor old Strom, who had a problem. We didn't know what it was, but he was clearly paralysed. His back legs were paralysed. We didn't know why. Got no idea why. And we really felt that it was cruel to allow him to continue. And during the time, I've forgotten even how we put him down. I remember he got hold of
morphine.
We injected him with something like that. But he got hold of my hand and hang on.
With his teeth.
And he put his teeth right the way through, yeah. Yeah.
Did you open him up afterwards?
Yes, we did. And we reckon what he'd done was, or at least he suffered from what can only be described as a hairball, except it wasn't hair, it was straw. And we think he'd got them from the paint store. And so he had a hairball in his stomach and from the paint store. And it may very well have been lead paint that he'd swallowed, and therefore it's lead poisoning that had finally caused his paralysis. Yeah.
Did you find any wood shavings in there as well?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, wood shavings in the...
in the straw.
Wood shavings, you know, yeah. That sort of thing. I can't remember exactly what it was.
Was this at Halley? Was this at South Georgia?
Oh, no, this was at Halley Bay. Mm.
All right. The cat came from...
Oh, the cat came... As a cat was part of the base cat.
Right.
Was it Strom or was it Kister? I really can't remember, actually. Anyway... It
was a Halley cat.
Yes, it was a Halley cat.
Okay. And I gather you also had some responsibility for stamps, didn't you? Is that correct?
Oh, well, I think everybody helped with stamping the mail. Yeah.
Were you postmaster? Yes,
the base leader would be postmaster, whether it was Morris or whether it was Dudley. But yes, we'd all helped. Yes, I certainly did, and I presume others did as well. And in fact, I remember I got a letter not that long ago, a letter I'd written to somebody that posted magazines and things down there. I never realised I'd written a letter to him, but that was published in a philatelic magazine, of which I've got. But I just don't remember. I can't remember that.
Will this be somebody called E. Jagger?
Yes. That was the one, yeah.
December 1964.
Yeah.
In the Polar Post.
Yes, that's
September
right.
2009.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. So your letters come back to haunt you.
Back to haunt me, yes. Okay. Never realised that I didn't think anybody could understand doctors' writing.
Shall we take a break and then we'll come back and do some more?
Okay.